From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Tana French has a new book out, and I had the pleasure of speaking with her about it last week. The novel is The Searcher, published by Viking. Tana French is the author of 7 previous books, including In the Woods, The Likeness, and The Witch Elm. Her novels have sold over 3 million copies and won numerous awards, including the Edgar, Anthony, McCavity, and Barry Awards, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Best Mystery Thriller, and the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction. She lives in Dublin with her family. I've been able to speak with her twice before, so this is our third interview. The earlier ones were about her books Broken Harbor and The Secret Place. You can find those interviews on the podcast site. Here's a little information about her new book, The Searcher. Cal Hooper thought a fixer-upper in a bucolic Irish village would be the perfect escape. After 25 years in the Chicago police force and a bruising divorce, he just wants to build a new life in a pretty spot with a good pub where nothing much happens. But when a local kid whose brother has gone missing arm twists him into investigating, Cal uncovers layers of darkness beneath his picturesque retreat and starts to realize that even small towns shelter dangerous secrets. I spoke to Tana French last week by phone. I started by asking about her main character, Cal, who is on his own, an American trying to make a life in Ireland. I asked her if she found it at all difficult at the beginning of the book to write Cal. He's pretty solitary as the book starts. Did she find it a challenge to keep things interesting? I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, he is, at least at the beginning of the book. I think
right.
That's kind of his plan anyway, because he feels at the start of the book that he's sort of messed up on most of his most crucial interactions with people. His marriage has collapsed in ways that he feels he doesn't fully understand what went wrong there, and his relationship with his grown-up daughter is distant and he doesn't know how it got there.
Right.
So I think he's feeling pretty tender about human relationships and feeling pretty much like he's somehow made a mess of this without knowing how. And so he doesn't really want any close relationships because he, I think, feels that he's probably just going to make a mess of those too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you, one thing that I am always drawn to is somebody working on their house. And one of the things he's doing is he's moved into this new place, you know, a tiny little house in a small village, and he's fixing it up. That gives him tasks and keeps me, I don't know, I just love that. I don't know why.
To me, there is something fascinating about the process of working on a house, especially something like his that's been abandoned for a while.
Right.
Nobody, it's not that you're moving into something that someone just moved out of and it's still a home. It's basically a shell with sort of the debris of somebody else's life
right.
when he moves into it. And so as he's cleaning it up and stripping the wallpaper and repainting, he's slowly making it into what he hopes is going to be his home. And he's reconstructing not just a house, but his concept of where he lives, where he belongs in the world. I've got a thing about houses and what they mean to people. I think that's, you know, fairly obvious.
Yeah.
this one's a bit different because it's just him reconstructing almost from scratch what he considers to be his place.
Right. Yes. And so as we read, we find out that he's got his kind of 25 years in the Chicago PD gave him this kind of spidey sense that he knows when someone's watching him. And he feels like someone's watching him. And that's just right away, we're into suspense. You know, it's very exciting. We want to know who's watching him. Did the book kind of evolve as we see it now, or did you start in another place and then go back and write a new beginning? I'm always curious about that.
No, it started very much from what's the start for a reader as well. I don't tend to plan ahead. I tend to just have a very basic premise and a core location and a main character, a strong sense of the main character,
mm-hmm.
and then just jump in. So I just, the first image I had was very much of this guy, this sort of stranger in town in the west of Ireland, it's starting to feel like someone is watching him and not knowing why. And I only had a vague sense of why at this point, but I just liked this idea of someone on what was supposed to be the most peaceful, rural, beautiful place in the world, in his view, suddenly feeling like he's being watched and like he has to bring back a side of himself that he had hoped to get rid of.
Mm-hmm. And we should say he's an American, which I found really interesting. And one of the aspects of this that I loved the most was when he's in dialogue with someone else, and a lot of his dialogue is with his neighbor, Mart, who's Irish. And, you know, that's really interesting to see how you went back and forth between the Irish and the American dialects in dialogue. And I wondered if that was hard.
A little bit it was. What was hardest, I think, was making sure that I was aware of the moments where one of them would misunderstand the other or wouldn't really know what on earth the other meant by some phrase. You know,
There'll
be phrases that Mart uses that presumably would make very little sense to Cal. So I had to keep an ear out for that rather than code switching too easily. I thought a bit about making him an American because, like, I haven't lived in the U.S. since I was 7. I don't have a very strong sense of how an American, I'm not sure that my sense of how an American speaks is quite strong enough. I knew there might be mistakes that would creep in there, but he kind of had to be. Like, what I wanted was, do you know that stranger in town who kind of strolls into the saloon in the Westerns with a secret or two and you know, refusing to answer questions, and you know something's going to happen around him. Like, he might end up shooting the sheriff and setting the town to rights, or he might end up, like, shooting the hero and wrecking everything, or he might end up getting shot when the town closes ranks against him. But he's going to cause change, this outsider. He's going to be a catalyst who, like, disrupts the patterns and brings hidden things to light. And for him to be a proper outsider in this small town, he couldn't be Irish, because Ireland is so small that even if he'd never been anywhere near this village before, he would have some connection to it. Like, he would have gone out with a girl whose family was from there, or he would have known a guy from there when he was in training to be a policeman, or he would, you know, play poker with somebody whose uncle lived there. And within, like, an hour, Noreen, the shopkeeper and the kind of information repository, she would have found that out. And he'd be connected to the town in some way. I needed somebody who wasn't connected in any way, who was a pure outsider. And for that, he couldn't be from anywhere in Ireland. Mm-hmm. He had to be from a whole other country.
Sure.
And even then, I couldn't make him from New York or Boston, or there would have been some Irish connection in there somewhere.
Right. That's interesting. Now, I do think it was, I think there's a benefit to writing a mystery set in a small town where everybody knows everybody else's business. And as an outsider, they would take a little while to get to know his, but they do soon enough. It can lead to clues, but it can also lead to kind of like obfuscation. So I thought that was kind of fun. And I just really enjoyed reading about the town and the people and the culture, and what, like you said, like how Noreen knows everything, and Mart sort of knows everything too.
And
he's an interesting character. But do you mind if I read just a couple sentences?
Yes, absolutely.
This was something else I loved. So he is in the bar, and he thinks to himself, around here, mockery is like rain. Most of the time, it's either present or incipient. There are at least a dozen variants, ranging from nurturing to savage, and so subtly distinguished that it would take years to get the hang of them all. I thought that was perfect, because the humor is very different there than it is here, isn't it?
I think we show affection, especially men, show affection by slagging the hell out of each other in a way that I think to most cultures is very strange. I'm part Italian, and one of my Italian cousins was overstaying with me years back. We went to the pub with my now husband and a bunch of his friends, and, you know, my cousin was just listening to them have a conversation and take the mick out of each other, and he turned around to me and said in Italian, "Tana, do they hate each other?" No, they've been best friends since they were teenagers. They love each other. This is how they show it, by calling each other unspeakable things.
Oh, that's so funny.
I'm not sure it quite translates. I think it does take a while to get the hang of when someone is calling you a bollocks in a loving way and when someone is saying it in an aggressive way and when it's dismissive, because the nuances are so subtle and so fine.
Right. Yeah. And I don't want to take us away from The Searcher, but I will say that the other book that you did that so beautifully in was The Witch Elm, and the bar scene at the beginning of The Witch Elm. I didn't get to talk to you about that one, but that was just amazing. Just the way that they spoke to each other, those friends in that scene was just extraordinary.
I love writing friends. I love writing scenes between friends.
Yeah. Now that does remind me, though, that both of your standalone novels, your most recent novels, are both standalone, I believe.
Yeah.
And they both have male protagonists. And I wondered, as a woman writing, how that felt to you now, doing two men in a row. And I know that you've done a lot of narrators that were either you know, male or female. But how does that feel right now?
Well, I have to say, I've always liked writing characters who are far from me in one way or another. And I guess maybe it comes from having been an actor for years, where I'm not interested in just writing about who I am all day, because I'm doing that all day. I want to, the whole point of the arts for me, of writing or acting or so many other things, is to try and catch a glimpse of the world through someone else's eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think there are clearly limitations on that. There are places where I would never be able to understand deeply enough to write from certain perspectives. But I think the differences between men and women, while they're real, aren't as crucial as the many other differences that you automatically write when you're writing any character who isn't you. Like, I've written murderers on a regular basis, but I've never killed anybody. And that is a much... For me, that's a much bigger gap in experience, the experience of having killed someone versus the experience of living your life without ever, please God, ever having caused serious harm to anybody.
Right.
I think that shapes your experience to possibly an even greater degree than gender. So I think if you're going to go into a book assuming that you're going to write people who aren't you, then that leads to the possibility of writing somebody of the other gender, because... Okay, I've always had a load of good guy friends, and I have a lot more in common with my best guy friends than I do with many women.
Sure.
So I don't find that to be as big a leap as some of the others I've taken in writing, or as intimidating a leap. Like, there are characters... When I'm writing a character, like in Broken Harbor, the main character is someone with whom I have very little in common. He's very sort of... rule-bound and very serious about sticking to the rules, mm-hmm. disregarding your own instincts, just do things the way you're supposed to do. I am not very much like that. And in real life, I don't bond with people who are like that particularly. So the challenge of going into a character like that, with whom I have really very little in common, and trying to give him the respect of not being judgmental, of understanding why somebody would be like that, why it is not something to be mocked or made fun of or belittled, that for me is a bigger leap than going, I'm going to write a guy with whom I, you know, might or might not have a few things in common. Those are the intimidating ones, where you're going, I am tempted to judge this character and to minimize mm-hmm. him in some way. Those are the ones that I find dangerous and intimidating, more than just simply writing a guy versus a woman.
Okay. All right. Great.
That makes sense. Sorry.
It did. No, it did. It totally made sense. I think part of the reason I asked it was because there are certain scenes mostly in the bar scenes, you know, where there's a very sad woman who's alone at the bar a lot. And the men, you know, are sort of very ribald in the way that they talk about women. That's not even a word I ever use. But anyway, I did. and, you know, and so there's a certain condescension toward women in the way that they talk to each other. And I just sort of wondered, too, like, how is it to write that sort of a scene as a woman? You know, you got it just right, but is it at all irritating to get it right?
I guess, but to be honest, I find it less irritating when I'm writing about an older generation.
Right.
When I was writing, for example, about some of the attitudes in 20-somethings in The Witch Elm.
Yes.
Where I feel more... It's much more frustrating to go, hang on a second, there are still 20-something guys now who are totally dismissing the idea that women could have a different experience of life from them. Whereas when you get older guys who've grown up in a very different society, which was very heavily dictated by the Catholic Church and its principles and its attitude towards women, I find it less frustrating, less irritating. And there's also still there's that sense that you have a duty to the characters to get them right and not judge them and just be honest about them. And
right.
if there are judgments to be made, let the audience make them. It's not my place. So all I need to do is get them right.
That's such a good point, because I think you can ruin a good character if you don't depict him honestly, and these people would act exactly like they're acting. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to either kind of patronize everyone concerned by changing it to fit with my own sensibilities or by sort of having the author intrude by finger wagging about how what a terrible thing this is. It's just lay it out, let the audience decide.
Yeah, great. Let's see. One thing that I noticed is that you do always let us know, I think, always let us know what characters look like. And I think pretty quickly. So, for example, there's a kid in this book, I love this kid. And when he first shows up in a scene, he's described as mousy buzz cut, too big faded red hoodie, ratty jeans. He's maybe 12. And I just wondered, how important is it to you to let us know what a character looks like? And do you ever wait a little longer, or do you usually feel like you want to get that off of the reader's mind right away so they don't have to think about it?
I think there are usually a few aspects of the character that I really want to get out there, of the way the character looks, just because for whatever reason, that particular angle of the mental image is going to matter to how the character comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Trey, there are certain aspects that, for reasons that presumably become clear later, probably needed to be made clear up front.
Yes.
And, you know, there are elements of Mart as well and of Lena that kind of needed to be established up front. I reckon if I'm going to describe a character, I always feel like it's fair to do it relatively early on, because otherwise you've got the reader going, ah, okay, I'm picturing her as kind of small and scrawny and dark, and then 100 pages later I'm going, she tossed back her blonde hair and, you know.
That's always very disconcerting when it's like, what?
Yeah, they're going, that's not her. Hang on a second. I'm sure she's dark. So I figure get it up front so that they don't spend their time building up an image only for me to mess with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is sort of related. And that is, I love that you get the gestures right. And you don't just give us the cigarette, you know, being ashed over and over and over and the same gestures that we see everywhere. You know, at one point, Trey is pulling at a frayed piece on the knee of his jeans. And he's using that moment to try to come up with the right words for something he wants to say. And it really stuck out. It was like, oh, that's a great gesture. Do you work on that, or do you collect those when you're out in the world watching people?
This is where the actor thing kicks in again.
I
find myself doing it as I'm writing. I find myself sitting there kind of feeling, how's Trey going to be fidgeting? Is he going to be like scratching his neck? No, that doesn't feel right. Is he going to be pulling at a shoelace? No. Is he going to be, and then, you know, you find yourself kind of picking at the knee of your jeans and going, okay, there's, that feels right. That feels like him in that moment, kind of physicalizing it.
Yeah, okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about setting. I think you do this great job of both creating mood and also sort of filling in information about your characters with setting, the things that are important to them. You know, so Cal really, he loves the rain where he now lives. And he didn't love it in the city. And he has a lovely sort of rumination on that. And he describes the rain. He also brings in, you bring in the smells, you know, the scents that are there. And you're just wonderful at doing this. So I'm wondering, you know, again, are you taking notes when you're in various situations, or are you just sort of, you know, like living in that moment as you're writing it?
Well, I love the West of Ireland. For this one, the setting was a joy to write because it's so beautiful, and it's completely different from the beauty of the East, which is where I live, which is much gentler and, you know, rolling hills and lush greens. And the West is wilder, and it's harsher, and it's got rocky bits, and it's still got those beautiful greens, but the wind is a different thing, and the colors are different shades, and they've got that wilder edge. And you do find yourself not exactly wording things, but noticing. You know, every time I've been down in the West, I find myself noticing, oh, look, the way the sky is different here from what it is where I live, or the way the wind feels that little bit different, or the smell is different. And those stay kind of filed away in the memory bank to be pulled out if I should ever write about the West of Ireland, which I ended up doing.
Yeah. Now, it struck me that Cal is a great character, and there are lots of authors who would then want to take him and make him a private investigator in a series. And I sort of suspect you're not going to do that. And I'm first of all, am I right that you would not be doing that?
Well, I'm not planning to. I don't have any plans for him. But I loved writing him. He was really nice to spend time with for a couple of years. So I'm not ruling it out if any other idea should pop up. But I don't have any plans
for
that at the moment.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you've had so many great narrators, and it strikes me that you like working with new ones. Is that right?
Oh, yes, it is absolutely right. Again, I'm coming from being an actor. I've been playing the same character for 2 years. I love them, but it can be time to move on. I want to try somebody else. But there's also the element of, I like writing about the big turning points in someone's life, the huge moments where you're like, right, this defines the way their future is going to pan out. And we don't mostly have that many of those moments in life. I mean, if we had too many of those huge life-defining turning points, we'd all go mental. So that's why I started kind of switching narrators to begin with, because right. I was going, I can keep throwing this poor guy into massive crises every couple of years, in which case he's going to end up in a straitjacket by book three, or I can switch narrator. And I like the idea of seeing things from a different perspective every time. Again, to me, that's one of the points of what I do, is trying to catch a glimpse of the world through someone else's eyes and realizing that their perspective is just as real, just as valid as mine.
Right.
I like doing that. I like switching.
Yeah. Now, so my next question might kind of be irrelevant then, because you do like switching, but you've written cops pursuing criminals, and you've written from, you know, the other side, the people who are being investigated or being helped or being, you know, sought. And now you've written an ex-cop. And I'm just wondering, did you find all of them sort of equally satisfying, or is there a certain category of person you most like spending that 2 years with?
Huh. That's a really interesting one. I hadn't thought about it.
Okay.
At the beginning, I really enjoyed writing detectives because I loved the kind of the arcana of the detective world, where they've got their own terms and their own structures and their own methods and mindsets. And that's a fascinating thing. But I kind of got antsy around that after a while, going, there's so many other perspectives in an investigation. There's the killer, there are suspects, there are witnesses, there's the victim, and all of these perspectives matter just as much. And we get the detective's perspective so often, but they're not the only ones whose perspectives matter within a case. And I wanted to give a bit of space to the other ones as well. And in Wichita, that's how it turned out, that the narrator is, in fact, all of those other things,
right.
As well as being, you know, trying to be a detective as well. And I liked that, but I found that I also really enjoyed Cal being the unwilling detective, kind of being pulled back into this when this was not his plan. He doesn't want to be a detective anymore, and struggling, torn between his desire to not be this and the instincts resurfacing.
Yeah. Okay, great. Now we mentioned that Cal is an outsider, and one of the aspects of that came into the narrative, I think, is that it sort of forced him to rely on intuition a little bit more than maybe if he had been part of this community. And maybe that's just who his character is, and it would have been that way back home in Chicago as well. But I found his intuition interesting. You know, he's got, as I said, this sense that someone's watching him. You write, after 25 years of maintaining an intricate mental database of everyone he met on the job, Cal enjoys the lackadaisical feeling of not bothering to remember. whether Sunny is the one with the big laugh or the one with the cauliflower ear. So that's, I guess, not so much intuition, but it's just sort of like he's enjoying not being on the job. You know, he has feelings about things. He can't shake this feeling that something's heading toward him. I liked his intuition and the way that you help us understand how he's feeling and what he's going through.
Thank you. I like the idea of him being out there on his own. He's unarmed, basically.
Right.
He has none of the usual artillery and backup and the cavalry to come in and the technical people and the CSIs and any of that stuff that he would normally have. He has nothing. So he's stripped away all the external trappings of being a cop, but he can't really strip away the internal ones. That's all that's left. So even when he has divested himself of any outward elements of being a cop, he's finding that the inner elements are still there, and he's very ambivalent about that fact because he's not particularly happy or comfortable about the cop side of himself, and yet it's needed here.
Right. Now, let's see. So I wanted to talk a little bit about plot. I wondered a few things about plot. I feel like you unfold your plots sort of at your own pace, and it's always really engaging. Like, as I said at the very beginning of this book, I was just engaged with his, you know, working on his house, but then something comes and then something else comes and then all of a sudden we're rolling along. So I wondered, you know, how quickly. I know that in the Dublin Murder Squad series, you're pretty much, you know, getting us invested in a crime very early on. Less so, I think, The Witch Elm likewise really drew me in, but we didn't know why we were interested for a long time.
Yeah, why are we here? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was there just for the characters. I loved them, but or I loved reading about their lives. But so how many? So first of all, how do you feel about plot? As far as like, do you have to get to it quickly, or do you not worry too much about that? And how many balls do you try to keep in the air? Like, do you worry about too many subplots? For example, his backstory, his wife and daughter, his ex-wife and daughter, his job, that sort of thing. Those things.
On plots, again, I write like an actor. Plot comes out of character for me. Like, I have a clear idea of the character long before I have an idea of the plot, because I have to write the character long enough to get to know them before I figure out where they're headed, what's happening around them, how they'll engage with their situations. So I kind of am aware that I probably don't get the plot up and running as fast as a lot of writers, but I'm hoping that the characters are engaging enough that people want to spend that extra bit of time with them until whatever the big thing is kicks in and the action can start. Now, this is not like, they're not thrillers with things exploding and gunfights. They're not, but I'm hoping that the characterization and the world are interesting enough that people will want to hang around there. When it comes to subplots and keeping too many balls in the air, I reckon it's more about how they all intertwine. If everything is essential for the character and for the development of the main plot arc, then it's much easier to keep everything in balance and to keep everything up and running. But every now and then I've found myself, not in this book so much, but in other books, with a subplot where I was going, hang on a second, this isn't working, it's clunking along, it's not weaving in with the other ones properly, and suddenly realize that it's because it doesn't actually inform the main journey in any way, and it just needs to go, just kill it. If it doesn't inform the main journey of the book, either character-wise, but also plot-wise or thematically or in some way, then, yeah, it can go.
Yeah. Well, and I would say in this one thing that works really well in that interconnectedness is that he's missing his daughter, Alyssa, and the old comfort that they had with each other, which has, as we mentioned before, kind of gone missing lately. He doesn't quite understand why. He's a bit baffled about that. And then this kid comes into his life, and it's like that is very interconnected. He's very drawn to having a relationship with this kid in some way. And I think that, you know, that worked really well.
Oh, good.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's trying really hard not to mess it up, and a big part of him is very sure that he will mess it up, but he can't step away. Yeah, because it's almost a chance at redemption for him.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you don't know where it's going when you start. You have character and maybe you have situation. Is that anxiety provoking for you, or do you kind of get into it and really love that?
Well, I mean, there's a part of me that envies the writers who have it all laid out, like they've got the chapter by chapter outline before they start writing, because they know there's a book there. They know that all these plot lines are going to come together into a satisfying solution, whereas I don't know for definite. There's always a possibility when I jump in there that I could find out a year down the line that, oops, there's no book there.
Has that happened?
No, not so far. The nearest is with one book I had a couple of thousand words written, and some suddenly went, this is going basically nowhere. Pointless, and scrapped the 2,000 words and started over again. But at least it was 2,000 words. It wasn't, you know, a year and a half of work or anything like that. But I know it's a possibility. But the thing is, this is the way that works for me. I need to keep finding it out as I go, because that's the way that works for me. So I figure I have to take the risk.
Yeah, yeah.
And touch wood a lot.
Yeah, I almost told you to go knock wood when you said that. That hasn't happened.
I was.
Let's see. One thing about this particular plot, because Cal is American and he's, you know, in this Irish community, I think he kind of puts on his Americanism a little over the top sometimes in order to you know, sort of sweet talk somebody. And I think that it's happening to him on the other side. I think Mart, for example, sometimes is a little over the top Irish. And I think he's using that for his own reasons, which we don't have to get into. But so I'm wondering, when you weren't purposefully doing that, did you have to watch how you were depicting these characters so that you did not jump into any charmed stereotypes just because they exist and you were juxtaposing these worlds up against one another? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that I kept a strong hold of that I figured would probably keep me safe from that is keeping an eye on the characters' agendas. What are their objectives? What's each character aiming for at any given moment? Because there are moments when Cal is aiming to be the big, sweet, dumb American, and he plays that up big time. And there are moments where Mart is aiming to be the innocent, rural yokel who, sure, big gar and big gob, we're all a bunch of great, you know, we're all great crack around here. But he's using it for his own ends. So if you remember that he's got an objective in using this is a tool for each of them.
Right.
It's a tool that he has in his kit that can be used. None of the other characters, I don't think, do that, but the two of them definitely both use either to find out information or to wrong foot somebody else. They, you know, they use playing up to certain cliches and to certain ideas that other people might have about them. And they use, they both use the gap between them, the gap between their cultures, as a thing that can work in their favor as well as against them. So if I just remembered that they were using that, it became easier to back off it at moments when they weren't using it.
Right. Okay. So I always like to ask my guests what they might be reading by other people lately that they might recommend to listeners. Do you have any books that you've been reading lately, or have you been too busy to read anything?
Oh, I have been. Do you know what's happened, actually, with the whole chaos that's going on and the pandemic and the lockdown and things?
Yeah.
Most of my reading, don't get an awful lot of reading time, and I've mostly been rereading the least mentally taxing things I can find. There has been a lot of Agatha Christie going on, like a lot of Agatha Christie. But one thing I would definitely recommend is a nonfiction book called The Lost Family by Libby Copeland. I don't know if you've heard anything about it, but it is a book about genetic genealogy and people who are the seekers who are trying to track down the solution to some mystery in their family. It could be, you know, anything. It could be generations back. And she explores just beautifully, not just the scientific techniques involved, but also what this means to the people doing the searching and their sense of identity, how it can shift and change around various kind of surprises. You know, somebody finding out that the half of her family that she thought was pure Irish American is you know, a really fascinating story. Actually, Ashkenazi Jewish. Does that shift your sense of identity? Or, you know, there's somebody who's meant to be the father in some line is not exactly, is not, in fact, the father. What does that do to your sense of identity? And she talks so much about how our senses of who we are created and how we recreate them as we discover new things about them. It's a fascinating book.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you. That's wonderful. I don't know that book, so that's great. Let's see now, what are you writing next? Have you started anything else?
I haven't at the moment. I'm still at the stage where I have the seeds of an idea, but I'm still sort of bouncing it around my head, and I would normally be getting started by this stage, but this is pandemic stuff again, it's COVID stuff, because I think when you're writing, a huge amount of the work gets done by your subconscious. And for me, like for an awful lot of people right now, my subconscious isn't functioning. It's a smoking crater, you know? It's just all used up by dealing with the day-to-day. So I haven't actually, I'm not where I should be. I have the seeds of an idea, but it's still sort of bouncing around rather than down on paper yet.
All right, great. So I like to finish these interviews asking for a piece of advice for writers. And in your case, I wanted to ask, this is actually very self-serving because I'm working on something where I'm the same way. I don't know what I'm doing when I start. I've just figured out what's going on. But I wonder if you have advice for finding and presenting the clues that lead toward where you're going in a book where there's some sort of investigation involved. You know, who knows what? And how do you figure, like, you feel like you're moving backwards. But if you're not careful, it'll just seem so obvious. But I don't know. I'm just curious what your advice might be on those lines.
I think for me, the big one is it depends hugely on whether you're writing first person or third person. Mm. In some ways, it's much easier if it's first person, because then you have all kinds of ways that you can conceal something from your narrator, because your narrator, different people miss different things. You know, there are emotional reasons or practical reasons why a specific narrator might miss something that would be blindingly obvious to most people. But if you're guiding your reader through the narrator's eyes, you have room to skirt them around this clue through the narrator, you know, using the narrator's personal biases or blindnesses to skirt the audience around that. I think it can be a little harder if it's third person, because then you don't have that leeway.
Right. And this is third person. The searcher is third person.
Yeah, which is a different experience, actually. So I suppose, especially for first person, the main advice would be to focus really intently on who your character is, what they need, what they see, what they miss, and what the reasons are within them that make them see certain things and miss others.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Are you writing first person or third?
Third. Bummer.
Which I don't know very much about, so your guess is as good as mine. I'm figuring it out as I go.
All right. Well, no, that's great. That's great advice for the next one, maybe. All right. Well, I want to just mention again, the name of the new novel is The Searcher by Tana French, published by Viking. Tana, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really am just loving the book, and I just enjoyed speaking with you again.
And thank you so much for having me on, and loads of luck with your book.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Tana French. You can learn more about her work at her website, tanafrench.com. Her new book is The Searcher, published by Viking. And a little trivia that I mentioned last week when I introduced that she was going to be on the show, Tana French used to live in Burlington, Vermont when she was a child, and she still has family here. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Tana French, who, as an actress, seems to have a leg up on many issues of craft as she writes. One habit she mentioned is her tendency to act out the gestures that her characters are going to make. So this week, try that. Your character has to admit to something shameful, or is feeling aggressive, or is really excited. What will he do that fits the situation and isn't the same old gesture that we've all read in dozens of books before? act out the moment. Try to get yourself into the frame of mind of your character. Go through her emotions. Don't ash the cigarette unless that is literally the only move that fits her frame of mind in this particular scene. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I've been closing out the show regularly with thoughts about the pandemic, encouraging you to try and support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, following their virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. This week, I'm also going to add that you still have time to make a plan to vote. Go online and look into what is required in your state, and then you can do that thing that is required. It is important. You might feel powerless to affect change, but that is incorrect because you are part of we, and we as a group have great power. I am not making a political statement. I am not choosing sides in this statement, although I am choosing sides when I vote. Voting is patriotic and it's very doable. This year, though, it does require a bit of planning, so make that plan, please. And for all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. Today's was the one on gesture. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know which authors you've been interested in hearing, or if you have any events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates and information. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it, like it on Facebook, talk about it on Twitter and all the different places. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week. And also, vote. Figure out how to do it safely and soon.